Hi, gang. This is Lesbian Nation again, and we're going to have the final installment tonight of the Jane Alpert letter, read appropriately enough during the last show in Gay Pride Month. Here we go. For centuries, feminists have asserted that the essential difference between women and men does not lie in biology, but rather in the roles that patriarchal societies, men, have required each sex to play. The motivation for this assertion is obvious. Women's biology has always been used to justify women's oppression. As patriarchal reasoning went, since God or nature or evolution had made women the bearer and nurser of the species, it logically followed that she should stay home with the children and perform, as a matter of more or less ordained duty, all the domestic chores involved in keeping and feeding a household. When women work outside the home, we have the most menial and lowest paid tasks to perform, chiefly because any labor a woman performs outside the home is thought to be temporary and inessential to her, no matter how she herself might be inclined to regard it. Naturally, then, the first healthy impulse of feminism is to deny that simply because women have breasts or uteruses, we are better suited to wash dishes, scrub floors, or change diapers. As newly roused feminists, we retorted to evidence that women might be intrinsically better suited to perform some roles than others by pointing out that men have been forcing these roles on us for at least 5,000 years. After such time, conditioning and habit are so strong that they appear to be intrinsic and innate. However, a flaw in this feminist argument has persisted. It contradicts our felt experience of the biological difference between the sexes as one of immense significance. To begin with, it seems obvious that biology alone would, in primitive societies, have dictated different roles and different powers as appropriate to each sex. And biological scientists have indeed assumed, for the most part, that the physical passivity of the female mammal during intercourse and the demands of pregnancy, childbirth, and nursing clearly indicate the role of women as biologically determined and inferior. In response to this, Shulamith Firestone, with the publication of The Dialectic of Sex in 1970, articulated the definitively feminist antithesis to this idea by denouncing biology as reactionary. Agreeing that biology had necessarily been an all-powerful determinant of social roles in the past, Firestone went on to argue that the advances of technology made this tyranny potentially obsolete. Women are still enslaved to their bodies, not because of biology, but because the patriarchy will not permit the use of technology to interfere with men's power over women. However, in Firestone's view, The Dialectic of History, in which the sexual relationship underlies all other power relationships, indicates that a feminist revolution is inevitable. This revolution will put technology to work to literally free women from biology, from pregnancy, childbirth, and the rest, thereby eliminating the last difference of any importance between the sexes, and ultimately causing the sexual difference itself to wither away in the course of evolution, together with all forms of oppression. I think that Firestone is visionary in perceiving the sexual relationship as the basis of all power relationships, and in predicting that feminist revolution will therefore result in the end of all oppression. However, the evidence of feminist culture, which has accumulated largely since the publication of her epochal book, suggests that her analysis of the role of biology was deficient, and that a third possibility, which is indeed a new synthesis of the previous views, might well be correct. The unique consciousness or sensibility of women, the particular attributes that set feminist art apart, and a compelling line of research now being pursued by feminist anthropologists all point to the idea that female biology is the basis of women's powers. Biology is hence the source and not the enemy of feminist revolution. The root of this idea lies perhaps in buried history. It has increasingly been acknowledged that the most ancient societies worshipped a female deity or deities, and that menstruation, conception, pregnancy, childbirth, and all other phenomena associated with female biology were surrounded with taboos. Furthermore, a number of these ancient societies were matrilineal. Property and social identity were inherited through the mother rather than the father. Whether women had any secular power in these societies is a subject of dispute. And most archaeologists and anthropologists have felt that women didn't have any power except over a few religious rites. But most archaeologists and anthropologists have been men, whose imaginations could not quite grasp a society in which women held real power, even a pre-technological society. For example, the section on Amazons in the authoritative Oxford Classical Dictionary spends all of one sentence dismissing the notion that Amazon tribes ever existed, though these tribes were acknowledged by nearly every ancient historian who wrote about pre-classical times. Feminists in many branches of science and historical research have been re-examining the evidence for the existence of ancient gynocracies, or women-ruled societies. Among the more visionary and lyrically persuasive, if somewhat factually problematic, of these recent studies is The First Sex by Elizabeth Gould Davis. Davis hypothesizes that patriarchal society began only after barbarian male tribes violently overthrew the ancient, peaceful, and relatively advanced gynocracies, in which women were not only worshipped, but were actually temporal rulers. These ancient gynocracies may have existed throughout Asia, northern Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and the Mediterranean area, and persisted as late as 2000 BC in some areas, such as Crete. Recent archaeological evidence suggests that Davis may be proven correct in the near future, and her thesis has been stated in a more tentative style than hers by several other highly respected scientists. The feminist conception of these societies is that there was no such sharp division as now exists between home life and societal life. Industry was carried out in the home, travel was limited, and the life of the society centered around the life in the home, in which women were the decision makers. Therefore, women held power not only in the home, but also in the tribe or clan at large. They decided not only family matters, but when to plant and harvest, when to go to war and make peace, questions of marriage and property, and all important decisions within the clan. Religion was so intrinsic a part of daily life that it was impossible for women to be at once worshipped in prayers and treated as inferiors in social relations. Instead, it could be argued, the very reason behind the enshrining of the female creative principle was the perception by women of the divine in their own image. Some of the extant literature which survived to a much later period seems to bear this theory out. For example, the earth goddess Demeter of the ancient Greeks is portrayed even in relatively late Homeric oral poetry as a maternal figure with a special relationship to women and children, yet with enormous powers over men as well. By contrast, the stern, autocratic, bloodlusting, and supermasculine deity of the Old Testament is much more appropriate to a patriarchal society. The women this Jehovah curses as whores and heathens are perhaps the very matriarchal queens whose powers the invading masculinist forces needed to stamp out for their own purposes. Whether or not the matriarchies existed, and whether or not the question is even capable of proof, to raise the issue of the interconnection between female biology and religious and secular power is in itself of enormous importance. It seems to me that the power of the new feminist culture, the powers which were attributed to the ancient matriarchies, considered either as historical fact or as mythic archetypes, and the inner power with which many women are beginning to feel in touch, and which is the soul of feminist art, may all arise from the same source. That source is none other than female biology, the capacity to bear and nurture children. It is conceivable that the intrinsic biological connection between mother and embryo, or mother and infant, gives rise to those psychological qualities which have always been linked with women, both in ancient lore and modern behavioral science. Motherhood must be understood here as a potential which is imprinted in the genes of every woman. As such, it makes no difference to this analysis of femaleness whether a woman ever has or ever will bear a child. Biology alone is in no way an adequate explanation of what it is to be female. Women have been exploited in our society for at least 5,000 years, and female powers have been correspondingly frustrated and weakened. The effects of powerlessness on us is nowhere more obvious than in contemporary motherhood. In the patriarchy, we do not rise to a position of special esteem and authority when we have children. On the contrary, we are denied even the few options for meaningful participation in society that are available to us as childless women. We react to this powerlessness in a myriad of negative ways, ranging from the overpossessiveness of our children, as in the hypertense Jewish mother stereotype, to utter self-abnegation, as in the Madonna image, to child murder, as in the myth of Medea. But feminist culture is based on what is best and strongest in women. And as we begin to define ourselves as women, the qualities coming to the fore are the same ones a mother projects in the best kind of nurturing relationship to a child. Empathy, intuitiveness, adaptability, awareness of growth as a process, rather than as goal-ended, inventiveness, protective feelings toward others, and a capacity to respond emotionally, as well as rationally. If matriarchy means society in which these are the qualities all human beings admire and strive to embody, a society in which the paradigm for all social relationships is the relationship of a healthy and secure mother to her child, then matriarchy means nothing less than the end of oppression. Interestingly enough, the materialist analysis brings us to conclusions similar to the ones I have just set forth from an idealist standpoint. In the Marxist dialectical materialist view of history, the vanguard of the revolutionary class is that group which is not only greatly exploited by the class in power, but which is also performing labor essential to the functioning of society. The ruling class is thereby forced to respond to demands which it puts forth in the name of the oppressed. A third requirement is that the class be potentially collective. Each member should not be severely isolated from every other. In classical Marxism, the revolutionary vanguard is composed of the industrial proletariat, who must sell their labor to the capitalists in order to eat, whose labor is essential to industry and therefore to society, and whose work process is socialized. No revolution founded on Marxist principles has adhered to the classic pattern. In Russia, the proletariat was a tiny minority with no influence at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. And Mao had to rewrite both Marx and Lenin to suit Chinese conditions, defining the peasantry as the vanguard in that context. The industrial proletariat in the U.S. today are a larger group than in either pre-revolutionary Russia or pre-revolutionary China, but are not, by and large, an exploited one. Through unions, they have acquired a significant share of power, and their right-wing views do not spring from false class consciousness, but rather from a hard-nosed sense of their own self-interest. Taken alone, Third world male industrial workers are much less privileged. And women in industry are the most exploited of all of these in respect to both wages and working conditions. But these very divisions of the proletariat show the obstacles to its solidarity more pointedly than anything else. However, if, with Firestone, we transfer our focus from economics to sex, that is, from production to reproduction, the Marxist terminology itself begins to make more sense. For there is very clearly a large group of women who, by reason both of exploitation and importance to the society, perfectly answer the requirements of the vanguard, and who are increasingly closely in touch with one another. These women are, of course, mothers. Mothers live by their labor, yet generally without standardized wages. If they have husbands who earn good money and are generous, they are amply supplied, but only so long as they can keep their husbands. Otherwise, they have little or nothing outside the necessities, and whatever they do have goes to their children first. The only mothers who do earn a standard wage for the labor of child-rearing are those on welfare, and that pay is barely enough to sustain life. The job is without guarantees or security of any kind. Its work day is 24 hours, work week 7 days, no vacations, no holidays. Total dedication to the job is expected, and yet a woman who works only in the home is regarded with some contempt as an unemployed housewife. Women with children are the women who most frequently suffer from headaches, fatigue, listlessness, depression, insomnia, digestive disorders, loss of energy, nervous tension, and other illnesses common to women. If the women who work in factories were all replaced by men, it would represent some economic cost to industry, but no alteration in the power structure or the basic assumptions of society concerning sex and class roles. The labor of these same women in the home, however, and of all women who work at child rearing, whether of their own children, adopted children, or someone else's children for wages, cannot be replaced on a mass scale without cataclysmic changes in the social structure. Mothers are a distinctly defined group. Nevertheless, their interests as a group are in no way opposed to the interests of women as a whole, but are rather intimately linked with these. For motherhood itself is only the concrete expression of that potential which defines all women. Accordingly, the domestic situation of women underlines the way we are treated on the job market. But the point of mother right is to reshape the family according to the perceptions of women, and to reshape society in the image of this new matriarchal family. Because motherhood cuts across economic, class, race, and sexual preference, a society in which women were powerful by virtue of being mothers would not be divided along any of these lines. Nor would any new division between women, such as between mothers and childless women, arise, because the root of motherhood and the root of female consciousness are, I believe, one and the same. Returning to my personal experience again, my self-interest in changing society is bound up with that of women who have children, much more deeply than it is, for example, with women demanding equal pay for equal work. Despite the fact that I am single, childless, and must work to support myself. If I had to sum up in a few words what I feel to be my own oppression in this society, I would say, the enormous economic, social, and psychological obstacles against bearing and raising children of my own. While my situation as a fugitive seems to all but eliminate any hope that I might raise a child of my own, even these unusual circumstances are only slightly more handicapping than any other woman faces when contemplating motherhood without marriage, or at least a stable relationship to a man. These obstacles and the tools to overcome them are beginning to be studied and developed by many different women, notably by lesbians who have or want to have children. The oppression suffered by women whose sexual preference is for other women is peculiar to patriarchy, it seems to me, and would be eliminated as soon as women ceased to be pawns in male power games. If mother right were the informing principle of society, it would make no difference whether a woman lived with men or women, let alone with whom she slept. A woman would be powerful and respected simply as a woman, and particularly esteemed as a mother, regardless of whom she lived with. For far from being in a position to exploit a woman because she chose to live and or sleep with other women, a man would consider himself fortunate if a woman only chose to live and or sleep with him. The conditions of life in the patriarchy are such that the overwhelming majority of women in the foreseeable future will continue to marry and raise children and to regard that role as the central one in their lives. This majority includes millions of women who also have jobs outside their homes. The women's movement is their movement not only because they are a majority, but because feminist consciousness springs directly from the role they play in society. Many segments of the women's movement are now beginning to implicitly recognize this truth and to act upon it. Now is making a major push to speak to the needs of housewives by agitating for an end to discrimination against married women by banks, insurance companies, and credit unions. Radical feminists are demanding less that women leave men and suggesting that it might be more effective in building a revolutionary base if women instead move to become the heads of their families. Outside the consciously political segment of the women's movement, housewives are beginning to unite and to agitate for their common interests, starting with lower food prices. More mothers are expressing their dissatisfactions and talking about their problems, while not necessarily seeing these as related to the women's movement. More women within the movement are beginning to experience their feelings as mothers as feelings which are integral to their identities as women. Demands relating to jobs, professional opportunities, and electoral representation will continue to be important, partly because the unequal treatment of women in these areas makes people aware of women's overall inferior status, and partly because increasing numbers of women want and need to support themselves with jobs outside the home. But the women's movement must and will begin to focus on those demands which relate concretely to women's role in child-rearing. These more radical feminist demands include wages for all women engaged in child-rearing, paid holidays and vacations, collective child-care centers controlled by mothers with the participation of all members of the community, including fathers, older children, and childless adults. Laboratories and research facilities to be turned over to feminist scientists so that research into contraception, fertility, pregnancy, and birth can be conducted in women's interests. Hospital and outpatient facilities related to women's health to be run and staffed by women. Self-help clinics financed by the government but under community control. Artificial insemination, sterilization procedures, facilities for extrauterine birth and related technology to be made widely available. Technology is a powerful tool which will free us to bear and raise our children in our own way at our own time. It must be turned over to women now in order to prevent its becoming an even more powerful weapon against us and indeed against all life. It is the uprising of women which will presage the end of oppression. But this uprising must be based on more than opposition to oppression and the definition of women as other. It must be an affirmation of the power of female consciousness, of the mother. The changes which it will embody can perhaps be better imagined as primarily spiritual and religious, rather than economic and social, though they will include and embody the latter. Thus, a more apt analogy than the Cuban or Chinese revolutions might be the Reformation or the Christian Revolution, or perhaps the revolution made by the patriarchy itself when the ancient gynocracies were invaded. I use these analogies because in each of these cases, the economic and political changes were enormous, but they followed rather than preceded sweeping changes in human consciousness. The ripples spread through the institutions from the masses of people, rather than the other way round. These were not, and never will be, gentle ripples. The oppressor is equipped with the tools of mechanized violence, as never before. We are only beginning to reclaim the ancient rage that will defeat his evil. Feminism is teaching us, again, the healing power of anger trained on the true enemies of ourselves and our children. And our anger will supply us the resources we will need against the man's weapons. Yet, from another point of view, we may remind ourselves that the violence of this cataclysm is no more nor less than the outward sign of a struggle of the human spirit. It seems very significant to me that simultaneously with the contemporary rise of feminism, there is a great rise of interest in psychic and spiritual phenomena. Because the women's movement gets lumped with the left in many people's minds, it is mistakenly regarded as narrowly political. Yet feminism concerns more than political power, essential as that is. It is closely tied to theories of awakening consciousness, of creation and rebirth, and of the essential oneness of the universe, teachings which lie at the heart of all goddess-worshipping religions. We are on the threshold of what all the ancient wisdoms, many of them handed down from matriarchal times, teach is a new age of consciousness, and simultaneously, on what seems scientifically to be a threshold in the evolution of the species as the genetic code is broken and life produced in the laboratory. Could it not be that just at the moment masculinity has brought us to the brink of nuclear destruction or ecological suicide, women are beginning to rise in response to the mother's call to save her planet and create instead the next stage of evolution? Can our revolution mean anything less than the reversion of social and economic control to her representatives among womankind, and the resumption of her worship on the face of the earth? Do we dare demand less? That was me reading Jane Alpert's letter. I've gotten a little music for you. The record, which I'm going to play for you now, or at least one selection thereof, is also available at Labrys. I think you'll enjoy it. It's called A Few Loving Women. Labrys Bookstores is at 7th Avenue South and Barrow Street. Well, that's the last show of the season. I'm going to be taking off for the summer, but there will be Lesbian Nation. I'm going to be playing reruns of some of your favorite programs at a totally new time schedule of which I'm not even aware. So you'll have to check with the station to find out when things are being broadcast. Meanwhile, I'm going to disappear from the city, and for those groups and individuals who I promised to interview, I will get in touch with you in the fall. And I will leave no forwarding address whatsoever, so you can't throw brickbats at me. This is Martha Shelley. Good night. Talk to you all in September.